apologize. I don't have my cheat sheet with me tonight because I just don't, sorry. So I'm just going to wing it for tonight. Valley Group does search the Western Hemisphere for the finest speakers in AA so they can come and share their experience, strength, and hope with us. And tonight's nominee for this category has a sobriety date of 11/4/11. He has held services as instructors such as H&I, reader, secretary, as well as sponsor. When I asked him what his favorite AA motto is, he said, surrender to win. So, with that being said, that the winner of this week's speaker is the moment we've all been waiting for. Kirk W. from Visalia. Woo-hoo!
Kirk, alcoholic. Wow. I've never been recognized for my drinking, except for maybe on a police mugshot. First of all, I want to thank Bill for asking me to come out here, and hopefully I can, you know, share some sort of a message, and, you know, you can leave the mess. And, you know, I'm grateful for Bill asking me to come out and do this, not only for that reason, but he actually plays a small part in my recovery. I moved here from Fresno about 8 months ago, and about 2 weeks after I moved here, I got kind of a rude Visalia welcoming. I was over at In Shape Fitness there at Mooney and Tulare, and my car got stolen, and right from the parking lot, and you know, I was right there in the parking lot, and, you know, I was not in a bad space, you know. My car had just got stolen. You know, God works in mysterious ways. Bill pulled up to that Portisubs right there, and I was, you know, I was in the parking lot, and, you know, here I was with 7-Eleven right here, pocket full of cash. My car had just got jacked, and, you know, Bill's trying to talk me through it, and I'm going, fucking tweakers. You know, I was really pissed off at the time, you know, and I'll never forget what Bill said to me. He said, you know, you need to take God with you and walk through this. And, you know, every time I see him, that kind of resonates with me because, you know, that's what this program does. You know, it puts people in hard lives where, you know, it's really remarkable how God does work in mysterious ways. And, you know, I was in a bad space at the time, and here comes Bill right there in the parking lot at that given time. And who knows what could have happened, but it was very, it was just kind of a God shot, a coincidence. You know, I'd like to wish everyone a happy holidays. You know, since I've got sober every day, it's been a happy holiday for me. Yesterday I got one more day I got the gift of sobriety, that unwrapped gift, you know. All we have to do is add batteries, you know, some assembly required, and that's God of our own understanding and, you know, those 12 steps. And, you know, that is, to me, far more beneficial and important than any sort of material thing I could get. And, you know, the way it's been for me is, you know, lately when people ask me how I'm doing, how things are going, you know, hey, what's up, you know, my answer is I've never had it so good. And if you would have asked me that towards the tail end of my drinking, I would have said I never had it so bad. And the difference in that statement and those two periods of time are directly attributed to God and Alcoholics Anonymous. There's no other explanation for what occurs and what is occurring now. You know, what happened, my story is not one of these, you know, I moved here from Fresno, and we have a saying up there, when you have one sobriety date, you're a candy ass alcoholic, where you come in, you have one sobriety date, you have no call it what you may, relapses or slips or second chances, but mine is one of those stories where God allows U-turns. I didn't get this the first time, and what happened with me, my first time I drank, I grew up in an upper middle class neighborhood in a city called Saratoga, which is up in the Bay Area. It's kind of in between San Jose and Santa Cruz. And, I was the black sheep in the family. There was no other alcoholic in the family. I have all high achieving, normie family members, and that added an extra layer of difficulty to my whole recovery thing, because we all know how, you know, normies are on a different wavelength. They don't understand. So, you know, being the odd man out made things, you know, difficult. And the first time I drank pretty much set the tone for my future drinking. It was on a family trip down to Mexico. I was 16 years old. My older sister and I wanted to, we had been in the car cooped up, like 10 hours on the way down. We stopped in San Diego, stayed overnight. We wanted to get out, and we went to a little arcade, and I was 16, she was 18. She was at the peak of, that chasing boy stage. And so there are two guys that, she met, and they wanted to go down to the beach and drink. And, so here comes the tag-along little brother, you know, the pain-in-the-ass nuisance. And so these two guys, what do you do when you got this annoying nuisance younger brother around and try to get him as drunk as possible, out of sight and out of mind? And, they accomplished that. I just remember them just kept handing me one after another. They were Bud Light bottles, and they were not twist-offs, and I thought I was being real cool to open them with my teeth. And, next thing I know, it was right around the time Bruce Jenner got all his gold medals, and I remember for some reason after about, 14 of these Bud Lights, and thinking that I was Bruce Jenner. And, they wanted to get rid of this little, pestering younger brother. So they said, okay, your gold medal is way down there at the other end of the beach. So I would go down there and search wherever. And then they would say, okay, it's out in the ocean. You need to go out in the ocean and look for it. So it was a cold night. I was fully clothed, jacket and everything, and went out in the ocean, and, was literally diving in the ocean looking for this mysterious gold medal. And, that's a theme in my drinking pattern. You know, if you read in Bill's story, there's right at the beginning when Bill, it was wartime, and he sees a tombstone, and it says, here died a New Hampshire grenadier, died drinking too much beer. And then it says in exclamation points, it says an ominous warning which I failed to heed. And that was my first time drinking, and I should have died. And it was that first ominous warning which I failed to heed. And that is a repeat pattern in my drunkalogue. You know, God has been looking out for me, because I should not be standing up here for all those ominous warnings which I failed to heed. And, each time I drank, that phenomenon of craving kicked in, and I didn't know what the end result was going to be. I didn't know if I was going to end up in the bushes somewhere, in jail, or in some other undesirable location for which I did not plan on being. And, the progression of the disease with me was very, I tried all those different things in the book where they talk about, here are the various methods we took. I tried, just I can't describe all the different ways that I thought I could do it myself. And the key word there being I. I never, got to that point to where I fully surrendered. That is why I, you know, when she asked me what is my favorite AA saying, I would have, you know, it was a no-brainer for me, surrender to win. When I first heard that saying in one of the first meetings I went to, you know, I thought that was pretty, you know, pretty wimpy. You know, I thought, come on, man, that's just giving up. Why do you want to give up like that? But, you know, for me, this 5'6" guy going into the ring with Mike Tyson over and over and over, I had to finally surrender to win because it was a, you know, it was a losing battle. I had, I had 3 DUIs, each one, the progression 0.24, 0.26, 0.28. And, each one, I read the police report on each one. I always had a way to beat the system. I always, lawyered up with some pretty higher, you know, well-regarded hired guns, knew the system and such, and was able to beat the system. Another one of those times, that ominous warning, which I failed to heed. I didn't get hit with the consequences that I deserved. I remember on the first DUI I got, I was very far in denial. You know, I was, and I got this special DUI lawyer. That's all he did was deuces. And he, I went to his office and for the initial appointment, and he, you know, he read the report and the BAC level, and he saw the report about how cohesive and coherent that I was talking with the officers, and I was not resembling, you know, the 0.24 that my BAC was. And he said to me, you know, based on your blood alcohol level and your size and your weight in this police report, it says a lot about your tolerance. And this was my first one. And he said, you might want to consider that you might have a drinking problem based on what I've experienced. And you know, I remember walking out of his office, slamming the door, saying, fuck him, who is he to judge me? And immediately going to a liquor store, you know, drinking over him. And, you know, one more time of that ominous warning, which I failed to heed. And, you know, just the progression of that, just it kept getting worse. I was coming in on court cards. I was forging court cards. I was doing everything to fully concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. You know, on page 30, that's one of my favorite paragraphs in the whole book, you know, where it talks about that point where you have to fully concede. There can't be any more of these lingering notions that we have. You know, maybe we're in these rooms because of some sort of freak coincidence or bad luck or bad set of circumstances or because of the family or the employer or the cops should have been in the donut store where they belonged instead of picking on me. All those things need to be discarded. You know, you have to fully concede. And that was the point to where I finally, surrendered my, you know, my last run was, it was an 8-day run, and, during that run, I don't know what it is for me when I would drink, I would become extremely cheap and frugal. I don't know where that comes from. And, you know, I'd literally like be in a blackout, clipping coupons. You know, the next morning seeing on my kitchen counter coupons and just tripping out about that, you know, I would literally risk, you know, a DUI to get a 2-for-1 burger, you know. I mean, it's just kind of a weird phenomenon that kicked in with me when I would drink excessively. And, on my last run, I had an apartment full of food, full refrigerator, full pantry, and I had this bright idea to go to Costco. It was on a weekend, and I just figured I could get some of the free samples at Costco, you know, at like 0.2 whatever. And so, you know, I go to Costco, and it was one of those days where I was drinking pretty hard during the day, and it hadn't fully settled at that point. So I go to Costco. Everything is, you know, in my delusional mind, everything seems to be going okay while I'm at Costco, although after hitting the free sample stand several times over and over, they finally kind of said, hey, you know, this isn't a meal, you know, you got to hit it. So, you know, ultimately I get, you know, the sample people like 7-8 times back and forth for little pieces of tri-tip. They kind of got wind of that. And so I get thrown out of Costco, basically, politely thrown out. And so at this point, it's really kicking in, and I'm in the Costco parking lot, and it was one of those, like, night and day type things where I'm walking out of the Costco, and then, boom, where is my car? And then, boom, major staggering problems. You know, it really happened quickly. And, so I'm trying to find my car, and then I just literally had that full-on spaghetti noodle legs, and I start falling in the Costco parking lot to where I could not even break my fall, and falling badly, head on the pavement, head on curbs, into hedges, and a fireman, off-duty fireman says, hey, come here, you know, you're not going to find your car, and even if you do, you're not going anywhere. And he gets on his cell phone, and I'm pleading with him, come on, man, why don't you just give me a ride home, okay? You know, the car is history, okay? We'll deal with that tomorrow. I live 2 miles away. Why don't you give me a ride home? So, you know, he doesn't want to. Basically what he would have been doing is being an enabler at that point. And, he called the authorities, and the ambulance came, and so I end up in the back seat of an ambulance, and then a police car comes, and they say, you have two choices. You can go in the ambulance, or you can, you know, get a drunk in public. And so I'm already in the gurney, so I just kind of laid back. Where are we going, guys? So off I go to St. Agnes, and, you know, for a alleged dry out. And I'm at St. Agnes, and the, I'm in St. Agnes, and they give me some sort of IV, and I'm sitting in there in St. Agnes, and I'm thinking, wow, well, just to backtrack, my drug of choice was natural light beer. That kind of goes along with being a cheapskate, you know. I was, that's pretty much what the end of my drinking was natural light beer, and occasionally I would step it up to, you know, Coors Light if I got a tax refund or something, you know, got a few extra bucks. But natural light beer was the end. So I'm in St. Agnes Hospital in the room, and with this IV in, and I'm thinking, shit, I still got 5 natural lights at home, you know. And so I yanked the IV out. And I don't know if anybody's yanked an IV out, but it is straight up geyser of blood, just straight up in the air. So the nurses get pissed off at me, and I'm like, I'm going AMA. I'm out of here. Where's my shirt? I got a ride. I'm going. So, you know, they gave me my shirt, and, you know, so I went back and, you know, drank more, and That was just my pattern. That was the disease of alcoholism with me. I just, once I started, I didn't know what the end was going to be. That phenomenon of craving would kick in. And, you know, and finally, after that last run, I remember I was at my apartment and, you know, of course, drinking more natural light. This was day 8 on my run, and I remember it was a Tuesday morning at 10:30 in the morning. My drinking had got to the point to where I fully isolated and just drank alone. That pitiful and incomprehensible demoralizing drinking. You know, the kind that you just shudder, that you get goosebumps thinking about. You know, it's the kind of stuff you don't want to talk about, but it's the reality of the disease. So I'm in there in my apartment at day 8, and there's a knock on the door. And, you know, I was such an isolator that, you know, I just figured, oh, cool, that, you know, somebody's here, company, I can socialize, somebody here to talk to me. And I didn't look through the peephole, and it was my sister, and this was basically my intervention. She knows somebody in the program who she had spoke to, and they said, yeah, you know, I've seen this guy, you know, I've seen your brother come around a lot, and we haven't seen him in a while, and that is a red flag for anybody who's a regular attendee in meetings when they don't show up for a while. So she chose to come to my apartment, and, she knocks on my door. She comes into my apartment, and 10:30 in the morning on a Tuesday morning, and I have the Price is Right game show on. And I'm unemployable Tuesday morning at 10:30 a.m., and that stupid lame game show is on, you know. And I was telling somebody a while ago, I said, man, you know, I could have at least spiced up my story, maybe had ESPN Sports Center on or something. But, you know, it is what it is. And so then, you know, that was where things ended, and living actually began. That was November 3rd, 2011, and I basically detoxed for a few days, and I stopped doing those previous countless vain attempts to control and enjoy my drinking like other people. I did, you know, with my slogan was, I surrendered to win at that point. And, you know, I found over my years that it was at that point that I stopped just merely attending meetings. Going to meetings alone for me is basically, this my story alone, was just warming a chair. I mean, there is a chapter in the book called Into Action. It's not called Into Attending Meetings. There's much more to this deal than just going to meetings. And I became a, you know, a AA connoisseur, you know, whatever you want to call it. I went to 2 or 3 a day. I did fellowship like crazy. I literally would leave at 6:30 in the morning, would not get home until 10 or 10:30 at night. My place was just sleeping quarters. It was meetings, fellowship, staying plugged in, staying connected. To this day, I have probably 90 numbers in my phone, and 75 of them are members in this program. And, you know, I was blessed, and, you know, I received at that point, things. For me, I get, you know, you hear a lot about things at the beginning, how things are extremely difficult and stuff, and I think from doing it so many times and trying so many times, I kind of had experience at this thing. So once I fully surrendered, fully conceded to my innermost self that, you know, things got well, things got better for me from the beginning. And, you know, about six months into my sobriety, you know, I'm up in Fresno at this time. I was blessed to get the current job that I'm at now, which is I'm a legal social worker for the county, and that brought me down here 8 months ago, and you know, lo and behold, I still work there. It's kind of a unique thing. But, you know, from that point forward, I still to this day, I hit at least a meeting a day. 2 meetings a day is my desired. I start out the morning at a meeting, and I try to hit one at night. And, you know, it's been a good ride for me through my recovery. And, you know, but about 2 months and 2 weeks ago, my sobriety came to the good ride and the positive and the gifts and the benefits of this recovery came to a screeching halt on October 12th. I was working down in Porterville on a high profile, high maintenance shaken baby case down there, and I received on a Friday afternoon, I got a phone call from a community regional medical center up in Fresno. It was initially from my mother, who was unable to talk. She passed the phone on to a nurse who said, Mr. Walde, you might need to get up here right now. Your brother might not live through the night. And I could hear my mom in the background, just that wailing, sobbing shriek, could not talk. And, you know, that is where, the biggest blessing of my diligent hard work in doing this program really kicked in on that day. I had to use those, tools in our toolbox that we sharpen and that we work on. I had to break those tools out and put those tools into use right then, because it was a very scary time. And immediately I was at a doctor's office at the time, and I said, you know, where's your restroom? And I went in and I said a prayer for my brother, for my family, and for myself, that, you know, I would not do anything stupid at that time. And, you know, I finished out the day. It was happened about 2:30 in the afternoon. I immediately returned the county car, jumped in my car, began getting on the phone to members in this program from Visalia. I broke out a speaker tape in the car. Right away, I put the speaker tape in. It was, it was a speaker that he started out and said, well, I'm here because I'm not all there. And I thought, you know, I don't want to hear an improv stand-up speaker tape right now. So, you know, I went for another speaker tape, and I just began using the phone, calling people on the way up, other members in the program. And, you know, I use those tools that I had been taught and that I've been working on for so long to save my life. I went to the Community Regional Medical Center, came off the elevator. The surgeon was there after doing 8 hours of 2 craniotomies on his head. He sustained a major head injury, traumatic brain injury. At the 7th hour, he coded, was pronounced dead, was revived. The surgeon, I walk off the elevator, and her first words were, in my years of experience, I have never seen somebody survive the type of injuries your brother sustained. And those are the first words I heard. And I immediately embraced my mother and my other family members were out of town. It was just her and my brother's girlfriend and some of her family members. And once again, I used those tools and I began calling people, and I was pacing the halls at the hospital, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I was at that jumping off point. And at that point, the elevator doors came open on the fifth floor of the trauma center, and AA angels came off the elevator doors. There were five people from the program that came off the elevator doors, elevators. A couple of them are in this room right now. And they saved my ass that night and that weekend. That night they stayed with me till 3 a.m. We had a meeting on the floor. We were, brought in Carl's Jr. We were joking around that we were sitting Indian style, taking our shoes off, Chinese style meeting on the floor, the fifth floor of the trauma center. And they saved me through that weekend. That Sunday we went to the Fresno Fair, and that is one thing that I continue to tell other people, that it's very critical in this program to stay plugged in and stay connected. And that weekend I was either with members of Alcoholics Anonymous or in meetings or at the hospital with other members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is what this fellowship does. I was at a an extremely vulnerable point, and they came off the elevator doors, and it was literally AA angels saving my ass. And there is a positive ending to this story, which is that he is now in rehab, physical therapy, and talking, and it looks like he will survive. And it's directly attributed to the power of prayer. God does answer prayers, and there were a lot of prayers, and there were a lot of people that helped me through this thing. And I'm just gonna close up with this. My hope for everybody who's trudging down this road of happy destiny is not just we're all striving for sobriety, but it's the ultimate goal. But my hope and my wish and my vision for you is that it is more, is that feeling of being comfortable in your own skin, that inner peace and that unselfishness that comes through sobriety, doing things for other people and not expecting things in return, giving it, giving people rides to meetings and not wanting gas money or coffee or a meal, just doing things for other people. Because, it's one thing to be sober, that we hear a lot about being dry and how miserable it is, but, for me, the unselfish sobriety is what I strive for, and each day I aim to try to help out the other alcoholic who's suffering in and out of these rooms, and coworkers and everybody. I have people that know me have noticed, I'm not the same asshole that I used to be, and I'm honored and privileged to be up here. I come to this meeting all the time. And in fact, a couple weeks ago when I was sitting next to somebody and they announced their sobriety date, and they said, "Oh shit, only 4 years? What is that person doing up on stage?" So thanks, Bill, for having the confidence. But, that's just, my hope for you and for me is just not just that dry sobriety, is for that, where you get to that point where you're comfortable in your own skin, and you're unselfish in your ways, and you help, normies and struggling drunks. And thank you, and God bless, and happy holidays.